Do I shut the no? So here we are in the second half of class. The lecture tonight is called "But Will It Be on the Test?" Facts, interpretation, opinions, and imagery in the study of globalization since 1492. And we left off with some discussion about the Hagia Sophia, this monument in the former Istanbul, which is now called, or the former Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul. If we can go to the docu-camera, where are we talking about? So between the Black Sea and the Aegean, a very strategic strait there. And if you look at this map, which is an old map of this part of the world, you'll notice that all of this green area is called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So this is the picture of this part of the world that I was introduced to in public school, Iran, Afghanistan. This part in here is the Soviet Union. And this is the domain of the former Ottoman Empire. It's also where the Russians and the before there was a Soviet Union in 1917, there was Tsarist Russia. And the British Empire has its base in India. So this is the zone where there was tremendous amount of tension between the imperial expansion of Russia and the imperial expansion of the British Empire. This is one of the most historically contentious parts of the world. It's kind of a meeting place where many of the peoples of the world converge. There's travel routes through here, very ancient civilizations. If you look at this map, more recent map, you'll see that there is a whole bunch of new countries, or, well, there are very old polities, but Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. These are new republics, or republics, parts of the Soviet Union that were never very well integrated into the Soviet Union. And certainly the U.S. government would have cooperated with Islamic regimes, Islamic activists, to encourage these polities to break away from the Soviet Union. This Caspian Sea here, this is where the largest resources of oil and gas are, unexploited oil and gas. So there is a lot of politics around who's going to get access to this oil and gas. Where are the pipelines going to go? Unocal was talking about building a pipeline through Afghanistan and getting out to the ocean. Now, of course, if you think about the politics of what's going on, the great area of growth of middle-class people is in China and India. Huge populations where, because of the economic prosperity, whole new classes of people are in a position to purchase automobiles and to live the lifestyle of middle class in North America. So, of course, where is the oil going to come from? Who is going to supply the oil? So one theory would be U.S. companies bring it out this way. And before the invasion of Afghanistan, there was a lot of politics around what was going to happen in Afghanistan. Would Afghanistan become the site for a pipeline? And of course, one approach would be to go around here and then by ship bring the oil in here, or will China just go and get it directly? So one can read a lot of the politics in the world right now. What's going to be the future of this area? And of course, you know, we hear a lot about Iran in the news. We've heard a lot about Iraq in the news, the invasion of Iraq, big oil reserves all through here. But it's in this Caspian Sea area that there is, you know, the great liquid gold of our time, oil and gas. And of course, the demand is rising so quickly, it's such a big question: who is going to be in a position to get this to market? Will we keep the same type of technology? Will we go to hydrogen? The United States is having to deal with the fact that it has an addiction to oil and gas. There has been an assertion by George Bush Sr., you know, the American way of life is not up for negotiation. We're going to have our SUVs. That's our way of life. But now there's starting to be second thoughts in the United States. So I thought this contrast between this map, which presented all of this territory as if it was some kind of single polity, and the reality that we now see is quite dramatic. So let me change gears a little bit away from the Ottoman Empire. And take us back to last week. Now, one of the challenges with these video conferences, of course, you're inviting people and they have the preoccupations that they have and the expertise that they have, and it's better if you can encourage people to talk about what they want to talk about. Everybody's doing this as volunteers. So Professor Roncour, I found his presentation quite compelling, quite clear. Usually when I hear a presentation that is as succinct and clear as that, I think to myself, the person has some mastery of the topic. To make something clear and simple and direct is takes sometimes a lot more effort than something that, you know, might seem sophisticated, but in fact is prone to jargon. And of course, it's my challenge to try to integrate this into a coherent curriculum that makes sense in a course called Globalization Since 1492. And so when you go on the internet, when you go in video conferences, when you invite in people and say, let's have a discussion, let's interact, you can't really predict exactly how it's going to go. And in fact, you want it to be spontaneous. You want there to be some free flow. I was trying to reflect back then, and I'm going to continue that, where I'm trying to show, well, this discussion about how you protest, how you do activism, how you do protest and dissidence. If we go to the docu-camera here, this was the title of the lecture: Protests and Dissidence as a Force of Globalization. So although it might seem that we're talking on a level that doesn't go down too deep, I thought it interesting to look at the word protest and to reflect on the reality that, you know, a very important word in our culture, which defines the preoccupations, the orientation, the beliefs of a lot of people, Protestantism, comes out of a protest against the perceived corruption of the Roman Catholic Church. And so to present this discussion about, you know, what might happen in student union politics or this protest here or that protest there, to try to set that discussion of our recent times and recent experiences in a deeper sense, that let's remember that this is how history tends to move forward. This is the volatile agency in history. So This illustration, I found it a very useful illustration, very clear, this idea of selling indulgences, essentially selling the idea that the Pope will intervene with God if you've committed a sin and you're feeling, well, I might be headed for hell for the rest of eternity, but if I can purchase an indulgence and the Pope will intervene with God in my behalf, I might have a different destiny. I mean, it seems so absurd in a way, but we're talking about history here, a different context, different time. And in a way, this is the old theme. You know, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So usually protests are directed against those who are controlling power and monopolizing power. And there is a sense that this monopolization of power creates the opportunities for wrongful exploitation of that power. And we talked about Martin Luther, the 95 propositions or theses, which essentially point out the corruption involved here. And then another powerful vehicle of the Protestant Reformation is John Calvin. And John Calvin, he comes up with this idea of an elect. He's very influential in Geneva, which becomes a kind of Protestant theocracy and becomes a hotbed of these ideas. And he's one of the leading voices of that society. And as I was reading this, it did occur to me that there is some connection here to the way we're talking about time. You know, my background is in history. And, you know, we rhyme off, well, this happened in 1492, and this happened in 1653, and this happened in 1715. But if you really stop and think, you know, identifying these moments in history in a time scale that is based on the life of Christ, you know, it's a pretty severe cultural way of marking things. Like, what, as a historian, shouldn't we talk about and think about time? Time is it's a difficult subject, and yet what can be more central to how things are connected? I think of, for instance, you know, the great cathedrals built in Europe in the Middle Ages, and you know, this glorification of the spiritual, of the divine. I guess the Masons who built these cathedrals tended to see themselves as an elite group, and there's much theory about the Freemasons, you know, having a great role in making decisions, a sort of secret brotherhood. But think of the period where suddenly the focus shifts, and suddenly these big clocks that are built in the town square, the idea of making time uniform, of having a central announcement of what time it is in the community. I mean, in a way, the real machine that drives the Industrial Revolution, is it the steam engine or is it the clock? I mean, once the clock starts to regulate us and put us in conformity with one another, you can regulate more and more people. It's a huge breakthrough. So I kind of see, you know, from the religious preoccupation to the secular preoccupation, you start to look at the clock and the great science that goes into it and the technology that goes into it. And oftentimes the clock ends up being on like the city hall or the legislature. I mean, Big Ben is a symbol of the British Parliament. So it speaks of you know, this effort to regulate according to a very precise vehicle. And then, just as standard time is made universal around the world, Sir Sanford Fleming gets these 24 time zones, along comes Albert Einstein and says, no, time isn't what we thought it was at all, and blasts apart a whole paradigm. And I come to think that is the crisis of the 20th century, this crisis of relativism. What we thought was universal turns out not to be. And yet there are universals, but who would have imagined that the constant is the speed of light. What a weird idea, you know, that the speed of light turns out to be the constant. So if you're the speed time is going all has to do with what trajectory you're on in relationship to the passage of light through space. And as you approach the speed of light, time slows down. This is what Einstein was saying. So after Einstein comes Franz Boas. And if you read the about the World's Columbian Exposition, I kind of emphasize Franz Boas's role. It's in the Web CT. So when I came across this phrase here about John Calvin, I connected it. Man's purpose in life, then, is not to try to work out his salvation, for this has already been determined, but to honor God. While Calvin did not, it's like God, of course, God knows the future. God knows the past. God knows the future. So God already knows who's going to go to heaven. So it's already predestined who's going to go to heaven. And this is this has powerful implications because it says that there is only a small group who are eligible to go to heaven. Other kind of human beings who are not in this predestined group, no matter what they believe, no matter how hard they try, they're not qualified. So Calvin is an important figure. So I'll go back to my chronology here, and we'll go on along that line. For 1541, John Calvin leads the radical expression of Protestant extremism adopted in Geneva. Henceforth, Calvinism, which will form the basis of Puritan New England's early identity, signifies the position that God has pre-selected a small elite of humanity whose members are the sole individuals eligible for admission into heaven. This sense of divine sanction adhering to the Old Testament Israelites has continued to permeate U.S. preoccupations with providential mission, American exceptionalism. So providential mission, American exceptionalism, manifest destiny, a very powerful phrase with religious connotations. Manifest destiny is a phrase invented in 1845 to say U.S. can go into Texas and take and annex Texas, and it's nobody's business. That's their manifest destiny. But the phrase describes a phenomena that is older than in 1845. And some would say United States in the Cold War or the War on Terror, there is this sense that there's a manifest destiny. There's a sanction, a mandate coming from God that puts the United States in a different position than other countries. And this goes back to John Calvin, I'm arguing. A tradition of evangelical Protestantism whose members deny the legitimacy of separation of church and state. So just to read that phrase again, this sense of divine sanction. And of course, you can read this, you can pull this off Web CT. Everybody has the ability with your student number to get into Web CT. So you can read this this whole chronology at your leisure. This sense of divine sanction adhering to the Old Testament Israelites has continued to permeate U.S. preoccupations with providential mission, American exceptionalism, manifest destiny, and the tradition of evangelical Protestantism, whose members deny the legitimacy of separation of church and state. The early literature written by the founders of New England and Virginia holds abundant references to the European pioneers of these districts as the makers of a new Israel, a new Canaan, a new Jerusalem, as God's chosen people with a providential mission on earth. The language of providential mission of the United States would find new forms of expression recently in the context of the Cold War and the War on Terror. Calvinist notions would permeate the religious preoccupations of the anti-monarchists in the English Civil War. Cromwell was a Protestant. He was rebelling against the idea of the Anglicans as a state church. Calvinism notions would permeate the religious preoccupations of the anti-monarchists in the English Civil War, the Dutch Boers in South Africa, and of the Orange Protestantism of Crown loyalists in Northern Ireland. So against the Reformation is something called the Counter-Reformation. So the Roman Catholic Church is dealing with the fact that there's a revolt in their ranks. These protests are spreading, and as it turns out, there's a new country that emerges out of the Spanish Empire. It's called the Netherlands. It's part of this revolt against Roman Catholicism. England, with Henry VIII seeking a divorce and the Pope not giving it to him, creates his own church, a Protestant church. And these countries that are Protestant countries tend to be very dynamic economically, because once you break out of the idea that you must communicate with God through the hierarchy of the church, and there's a whole host of priests and bishops and archbishops and the Pope, and only the Pope is in direct communication with God, and you must go through this hierarchy. If you seek an indulgence, you must pay for it. Or once you break away from that and you say, well, individuals should be free to communicate with God directly. And of course, this is very much tied up with literacy and printing. Suddenly you have printing presses, you have the Bible. People can learn to read the Bible. So this is very tied up with Protestantism. And I believe that the concept, if you can break away from the structure of the church, well, in business, this kind of frees you to be an entrepreneur. And a middle class tends to take shape in Netherlands and England. And Germany, too, is a big part of the Reformation. It's interesting that, the founder of the Reform Party, he is the son of Ernest Manning, Preston Manning. And this comes out of religion. This comes out of Reformation religion, evangelical Protestantism. And so this Calvinism tends to be a very extreme form of Protestantism, very evangelical. Billy Graham, you express yourself. If the Lord moves you, you express that. So the Roman Catholic Church have to contend with this. So they come up with the Counter-Reformation. And I'm trying to, in a sense, this is all part of, where is the West? Who is the West? What is the history of the West? I'm addressing this. So remember earlier in the lecture I referred to this article on 1534 to 1540. Ignatius Loyola founds the Society of Jesus as a means of stopping and countering the expansion of the Protestant Reformation. The controversial Jesuit order become an elite vehicle of scholarly Roman Catholicism. Jesuits become celebrated teachers to the ruling classes of Europe and the Western Hemisphere. They hear the confessions of kings, queens, and government ministers. Can you imagine what it means for the king of a country or the queen of a country to go to confession and say, "Forgive me, Father, I have sinned. I've killed so-and-so, or I've assassinated so-and-so." I mean, if you're taking the confession of a king, in a way, you're trumping the power of a king, eh? And you're giving that king the most secret kind of explanation and advice. So this was a powerful position to be in. The Jesuit order grows to be especially renowned for the scope and ambition of its missionary enterprises. Jesuits become Western civilization's religious pioneers in China and Japan. They adopt the role of evangelical partners and proprietors in the empire building of Spain and France, especially in the Western Hemisphere. You know the story of the Jesuit martyrs that Jean de Brébeuf and Lalemant are burned at the stake by the dastardly Iroquois, who we discussed, the people of the League of the Haudenosaunee. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church build this up. Have you ever been to Martyr Shrine in Midland, Ontario, St. Marie among the Hurons across the road? This was one of the first missions, major missions in Canada, in the interior of Canada. And the Jesuits became martyrs, and this martyrdom was publicized. And in a certain sense, this was the final fulfillment when you leave your society. You're the educated elite of your society. You go to the end of the world out of the conviction that you have something to share, and you're bringing religion to people who wouldn't have it otherwise. You're giving the possibility of everlasting life. The Chinese were not very, what did they want from the West? There wasn't very much that the Chinese didn't have internally. But they accepted the Jesuits because the Jesuits were good astronomers. They did have some things that the Manchu court could use. As I see it, the Jesuits are major agents of globalization because they go out all over the world, many places in the world. They attach themselves to the Spanish Empire, to the French Empire, they learn about the indigenous cultures, and they, to some extent, assimilate the indigenous cultures. In China, they dress as Chinese, they speak Chinese, they learn to conduct themselves according to the customs and the sense of politeness and, you know, respect. Meanwhile, back in Europe, they're saying they've gone native, they're violating the traditions they're supposed to be upholding. So the Jesuits are often very controversial. Sometimes they are subjected to very radical efforts to push them away or stop them doing what they're doing because, you know, they tend to exercise power, and that makes some people nervous. So they seek to create Indian theocracies, a goal they successfully achieved for a time in Paraguay. And this memory of Paraguay when the Jesuits come into Washington Territory, for instance, they're seeking to create another theocracy. I mean, there's different ways you can do empire building. You can move the Indians aside or move them onto reserves or eliminate them altogether. Or you can treat the Indians as the future citizens of your own religious community and try to convert them. This happened in Metlakatla. There was an Anglican theocracy on the west coast of Canada. William Duncan was the leader of it. And there was this whole theory about, you know, Aboriginal self-government within the framework of Christianity. But that was an Anglican experiment. This is, Paraguay was the sort of farthest advanced experiment in that. And you know, look it up in Google. It's if you're interested, if you're curious. The Jesuits' busy network of worldwide interactive communications became a formidable catalyst of intellectual and cultural globalization. So they write about these societies in Canada, and they write about them sometimes in a very flattering way, and saying, although they don't know about God, they obviously have a sense of the divine, and they respect their elders, and they raise their children well, and they seem very moralistic. And intellectuals read this in Europe and say, aha, look at us. Our society's corrupt. It's overripe. It's rotten. Look at, you know, our Versailles and these people with their wigs and their powder and, you know, and then they poo in the little pots. They don't have plumbing, and it's kind of this whole facade, you know, Versailles, you know, could be seen as an expression of, this has just gone too far. This idea of being sophisticated, civilized, makes people into ridiculous creations. We should go back to a more natural state. You know, Jean-Jacques Rousseau writes about this. Karl Marx reads Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I mean, there's sort of Jean-Jacques Rousseau leads in one direction, and John Locke leads in another direction. John Locke, the kind of philosopher of private property.